You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēden tokawingawa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. My name is Kaden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producers Sinat and Jasmine. Efa Akane coming up on the show for our weekly catch up with the Labour Party. I spoke with Shannon Halbert about the local elections turnout, the ceasefire in Gaza and the infighting in Te Pāti Māori. Sinat, what have you got for us today?
On City Counselling this week, I spoke to freshly elected councillor Shane Henderson about his campaign and what he's most looking forward to over the next 3 years in the local government term. I also spoke to Justine Smythe, chair of the Breast Cancer Foundation in New Zealand, about the extension of free mammogram screenings to women up to 74 years old. Lastly, I had a conversation with Te Punaha Matatini's co-director Marcus Luca Roche about the Science System Advisory Group's latest report and changes to New Zealand's science research funding regime.
Jasmine, what have you got for us today?
Today I spoke with Meg Duron, CEO of Te Kāhui Tika Tangata, the Human Rights Commission, on the mahi and obligations of Aotearoa as signatories to the UN Subcommittee on the Prevention of Torture to Aotearoa, in light of their recent visit here earlier this month.
He aha o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wae mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kawa e wari wari e ahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero ano, he pākehiri ruki ruki mārunga i te pai, tukutuku o erarangi poho, mihariki 95BFM, erakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Only 32.6% of eligible voters voted in local elections, the worst turnout in 36 years. In the main centres, this was only 28.8% of voters, compared to 43.6% in rural areas. Otago law lecturer Andrew Geddes told the Sunday Star Times that the public seemed to just be a bit sick of local politics, so won't engage. Foreign Minister Winston Peters has welcomed the ceasefire in Gaza. The deal was the result of negotiations in Egypt and a proposal from United States President Donald Trump. And politicians across the House have criticised Te Pāti Māori for the confusing infighting between members that has played out over the past few days. Labour leader Chris Hipkin says it is unclear how many Māori parties there are. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Shannon Halbert about all of these issues. I started by asking for his thoughts on the very low turnout in local elections.
Well, it's always disappointing for candidates, people that have put themselves forward to represent their local communities, where that's not backed up by people actually turning up to put their vote in. It's so important. And so I just wanted to acknowledge them and the work that they do putting themselves forward. It's a difficult thing. But we know that how people follow politics at the moment, you know, is less and less. We've got to do better and find different ways to turn out the vote.
What do you think can or should be done to improve voter turnout?
Well, local government in particular impacts, you know, all of our lives. I think of in Auckland, our public transport network is such an important thing. But we've got to find issues that actually gives people reasons to get up out of their house, to get their envelope into the ballot box and to make sure that their vote counts. So, there's a bit of encouragement for all politicians out there. Be very clear on what we stand for. Find issues that are important, that motivate people. But for me, it's also finding issues that inspire people.
Do you think the results of the election, even if based on low turnout, offer any clue into how New Zealanders are feeling?
Well, I think low turnout in Auckland, as an example, really came about because a lack of competition overall. When there's not a significant challenger for the mayoralty, I think that impacts on the election as a whole. What you saw in Wellington, as an example, was people got behind Andrew Little. I think that's great. In Auckland, they got behind Mayor Wayne Brown. But, you know, it's never a given, and I always encourage, you know, good competition, good healthy competition in those contests, because these are the people that are going to lead our largest cities in New Zealand, and we need them to do a good job.
Do you think these results say anything about what next year's general election could look like?
Well, Labor overall did quite well. I think we had Andrew Little elected in Wellington, of course, a number of councillors there too. Across in Auckland, I look at Mangere, we did a full sweep out in West Auckland. Labor was very successful. But there's still very much a balance of power, so to speak, between the left and the right. The council makeup is similar to what it was before. So I wouldn't read too much into it, but at the same time, I'm very heartened by the people that were elected in my own community. Richard Hills, a good Labor person, was re-elected, and John Gillan came in as a new councillor.
There's obviously been a ceasefire negotiated in Gaza, but does New Zealand still have a role to play in this conflict? Is it still important for us to recognise a Palestinian state, for example?
Well, of course, government should recognise Palestine. So we can work for, you know, walk forward together and acknowledge long-lasting peace. I acknowledge the ceasefire. I think that's a good thing. It's something we've been calling for, you know, for so long now, and this government has have dragged their feet on it. And I'm happy, you know, that we've taken a step forward with hostages being released. But New Zealand is New Zealand. We need to continue to advocate for good human rights, for people to come together when they need to. And I think we've done a good job of that despite the government not listening.
US President Donald Trump has called for a full pardon of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is on trial for corruption. What is your response to this?
Well, one of the things that I find difficult is following President Trump and his advice throughout this. But I acknowledge too that international relationships are important. And the Foreign Affairs Minister, Winston Peters, has been working directly with President Trump around that.
How much of the recent announcements around Gaza and Palestine will shape Labor's foreign policy heading into the next election?
Well, I think there's a lot to work through and to be considered in that. Labor wants to ensure that we continue to have independent foreign policy. That's a priority of ours. And no doubt Penny Henare, our spokesperson, will be speaking to that more in the new year.
Are you concerned about the infighting in Te Pāti Māori, given their likelihood as a future coalition partner for Labor?
Well, it's challenging for the left bloc overall, I think. When I think of Te Pāti Māori, you know, there's deeper relationships that supersede politics here. And so it's always sad when you see such a direct challenge both ways. And I really hope that they sort it out pretty soon. Most of all, Māori want to change the government. That has to be our collective focus. That's what we need to work to. And this is simply a distraction from that.
You have been quite critical of comments made by their MP, Takuta Ferris. Do you think his comments from a few weeks ago are still playing a role in the division within Te Pāti Māori now?
I certainly think that that's one of the issues. When we look at what Māori want, you know, we've had years of building Māori to be an inclusive group. My concerns with Takuta Ferris has been that he has excluded others from the culture that we celebrate and the deal that we speak collectively. And so, you know, politics has to be about bringing everyone together. A future coalition will require that too. And good leadership for Aotearoa New Zealand as a whole requires us to include everyone.
So how concerned are you that this could impact the chance of a left bloc getting elected?
In my view, it's too early to tell, but it does require urgent attention from Te Pāti Māori to tidy themselves up, to talk through the issues that they have, and no doubt that they will have been doing that. It's clear that the leadership in its current state has challenges with the people on the ground, the ringaraupa, and they will need to come together at some point. But there's still 12 months till the election. Certainly, we are focused on us as Labor. We will be contesting all of the Māori seats because we believe that Labor can achieve better outcomes for our whānau Māori out there. So, you know, that's our challenge. But as a collective and as a future coalition, the goal has to be for Māori to change the government, and that requires our attention now.
That was Labour's Shannon Halbert on local elections, voter turnout, the ceasefire in Gaza, and the infighting in Te Pāti Māori.
That was our weekly chat with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Local elections wrapped up this Saturday across the country, with Auckland recording the lowest voter turnout in decades. However, as councillors and local board members settle in for the next term, I wanted to talk to Councillor Shane Henderson about how leaders from across our city step up and campaign, and what his community is looking forward to over the next term, and what sort of reforms he wants to pursue to stem this decline in local democracy. So Shane, obviously, local elections are over now, and you have won back your Henderson Massey, is that correct?
Yes, I'm Waitakere Ward Councillor.
Waitakere Ward Councillor.
They had a great result as well.
Yeah. So I just wanted to get an insight. You've won, but how did you campaign over the last wee while? What was your strategy? What do you think your pathway to victory was in this election?
Yeah, well, I could sort of talk all morning about this, but I think the most important thing is to take your ideas to the people, you know, on their doorsteps, on their streets, and work with the community that you want to represent and sort of try and reflect their ideas and bring some of the ideas that you have to them as well for a democratic mandate. So, you know, we went out there and door knocked to thousands and thousands of people and had a yarn with them about kind of what they want us to do. And the cool part about that is you get back in and then you've got a bit of a to-do list. So we've got plenty of things to follow up and never a dull moment in local government, of course, but yeah, I think the pathway to victory for us was really just like working with the community closely and understanding their concerns and trying to work on them as best we can. Yeah,
that's really interesting because oftentimes, you know, as a candidate, you'll have a set of ideas or policies that you want to enact, but when you go out and door knock, sometimes that might rub up against the interests of your community. Sometimes your community might not like what you're pitching to them. How do you deal with that or navigate that tension?
Yeah, and that's one of the challenges as a regional councillor is that occasionally, so technically I represent the entire city. I'm just West Auckland's voice within that city. And sometimes there'll be policies that on a citywide level we have to enact and they may not necessarily be the perfect solution for West Aucklanders, and so that's kind of that internal tension. It's really a challenge as a regional councillor. So you got to work with your community on that and try and understand their concerns and their needs, because obviously there's huge controversial issues all the time in local councils. The more you can kind of understand how your community feels and sort of what's underpinning their sort of opinions, if that makes sense, the sort of better you'll be and the better decisions you'll make. And yeah, that also goes for the campaign trail too, is kind of understanding people's needs, I think, is the number one issue, and getting to people where they are. Yeah.
What are the good people of the Waitakere Ward, or what were they bringing to you throughout the campaign? What are the sort of concerns, what are the sort of aspirations they're looking for in the next 3 years for you to solve and get a move on?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of issues there. So firstly, I sort of ran a campaign based on the cost and availability of transport. So we brought the $50 weekly fare cap in last term, and I'm really proud of that. But at the same time, we recognise that that's not going to be enough when we're dealing with a cost of living crisis. And especially for students and people on low incomes that are struggling, we've got to help people as best we can. And so a way that we identified that is to lower the fare cap. So I'm expecting advice to come back early in the new term, which will sort of give us a figure that we could look to aspire to, which I'm really proud of. And that was one of the things that I ran on. as someone that, you know, cares about this a great deal. But you know what? Campaigns can surprise you sometimes. And one of the things on the doorstep that I got quite a lot of feedback about was elder adults housing. People are kind of looking at the other end at retirement and thinking, goodness me, we're an aging city and we don't necessarily have the housing and the infrastructure and availability for older people, especially ones that don't have a lot of income. And so, you know, I'm open to ideas on how to work on that issue, but it's something that my community really wants us to work on. And so I'm taking that on board and we'll see what we can come up with in the next few years, yeah.
So beyond the public transport fee cap and housing particularly, because I know you're quite strong advocate on that issue, What are your biggest things in the agenda in terms of what you're looking forward for in the next 3 years? What excites you the most about the next 3 years as being a councillor?
Yeah, there's a couple of things that really excite me and something that I think excite our community as well. One of those things is a second public swimming pool. So it's a West Auckland concern I appreciate for the rest of the city. But we have one swimming pool to cater to over 200,000 people, and that's not enough. And in a growing community, we need some more infrastructure in that way. So I managed to secure $15 million in the last budget, but we're going to be working on that and hopefully getting spades in the ground in this term. That's the goal. The other thing is, you know, there's a lot of reform coming in terms of transport, of course, but also housing. Looking at that new zoning and looking at more intensification along rapid transit corridors and things like that, how can we plan our city in a much smarter way? And so that was actually a big motivation for me running again, so I can kind of see those changes through and sort of help on the planning of our city. So it's all really exciting, and I can't wait to get into it.
Anything that doesn't excite you, anything that's filling you with a little bit of trepidation or dread as you go into this next term?
Honestly, man, not really. It's a huge privilege to represent the good people of West Auckland on our city. I'm really excited to get into the challenge. There's obviously going to be things here and there along the way, but we work together as a community on that, and I think we'll be all good.
Now, if you were giving advice to someone who is listening to this interview and says, hey, you know, I think I could do this. I think I could go out and knock thousands and thousands of doors. What sort of advice would you give them if they wanted to be a candidate? How do you think they should operate in the space? And, you know, how do they protect themselves as well? That's a key question to ask.
Yeah, well, firstly, we need as many diverse voices around our democratic processes as possible. So particularly if you're listening to this as a young person from a minority community or anything like that, then jump in, man. It'd be really great to have you around the table in the future. And in terms of the campaigning side, I think don't get daunted about it. Have a yarn to people that sort of know and that have done this before, and I'm more than happy personally to have a yarn with anybody, for example. And talk you through kind of the here's and there's of it, because, yeah, it can be a really positive. It sounds like a lot of hard work, but it's a really positive experience because you're dealing with people and having yarns about things that matter to them and their community. That's really cool and really powerful. So those are a few pointers, I suppose.
Now, I guess the last elephant in the room in terms of this local election was the dire, dire voter turnout. And what it says about the health of our local democracy. During this next term, Shane, what do you want to try and do from as a councillor and with your council colleagues as well to improve that voter turnout or do something about the way we run our local elections so that, you know, that isn't as low?
Yeah, we've tried going around the edges of this problem, making tweaks here and there, and I'm convinced that actually we need some more bigger structural reforms on how we vote, things like the Electoral Commission running things. Looking at polling days, which I voted for in the last term, but unfortunately didn't get across the line. But making election day the big day and a day that we can teach, sort of especially teach tamariki and things like that about civic engagement through that and build kind of generations of voters. So making it a big event to vote as opposed to kind of a month-long stretch out where, oh, maybe I'll get around to it, maybe I won't, it might be on the top of the fridge for a few weeks. We need to kind of change that and break that and make things more of a spectacle, I suppose, in terms of you know, the voter engagement and voter reach. The other thing is, it's kind of a something not just structural, but people need to sort of get a sense that they're voting for something, right? And the book sometimes can be a bit unreliable. It can be the same sort of five quotes from everybody and every candidate. So yeah, that's a challenge for candidates to sort of differentiate themselves in the market and give people a reason to vote. That's kind of the other thing too.
That was Councillor Shane Henderson on his campaign, the goals for the next term, and what needs to happen in order to rejuvenate low voter turnout.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95 BFM.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. Text in your thoughts, 5395.
Splore is back for the summer, so if you want to win a pass to a party like no other, with an insane lineup by a pristine beach, with a bunch of friends you haven't met yet, then grab that B-card and stay tuned to 95BFM Drive all week for your chance to win.
Splore 2026, Beachside, Tāpapakanga Regional Park, February 20th to 22nd. Get your tickets at splore.net.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask, your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
What if you call it?
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Do you growl towards the weekend on a Friday afternoon like the cockroach that hides in the corner of your room and crawls towards your sleeping face at night to slither inside your ear and lay its eggs?
Well, it's lucky we have the show to jolt you awake and stop all that disgusting crawling.
It's the Friday 2 to 4 with a brain-birthing cast of DJs ready to get you hyped for the weekend.
You ready to read your first ever ad?
Maybe.
Not nervous?
No.
Loosen up, you'll be fine. Just read the script. Off you go.
Tune into breakfast on Mondays. Hear about some books from some pretty smart people, and they love books. You'll hear about, like, books you want to read or maybe you haven't heard of. How was that?
Pretty loose. Let's try another.
It's Loose Reads, Mondays on 95BFM Breakfast, thanks to Time Out Bookstore, 432 Mount Eden Road.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
This Breast Cancer Awareness Month, Breast Cancer Foundation New Zealand is celebrating a landmark moment for women's health today, as the government has officially extended breast screening nationwide to women aged up to 74. After campaigning for 8 years to increase the screening age limit from 69 to 74, the Foundation's chair, Justine Smythe, says the national rollout marks a significant victory for early detection. I spoke to Justine about the changes, what they mean for families and communities across the country, and their advocacy journey to get this win. Good, Justine. Thank you so much for being here with us today. I was wondering if you could talk to me a little bit about the recent changes in breast cancer screening.
Oh, absolutely. Very happy to. We've had what we consider a massive win for us at the Foundation in terms of the free screening age for mammograms being increased from the age of 69. Now, women will be able to be screened from ages 70 through to 74, so that means two extra screens for them. And we've been advocating for this for a good 8 or 9 years. I remember going down to Parliament with our 10,000 signature petition back in 2016, and we've been advocating very hard for that ever since that time. And the reality is that early detection, saves lives with breast cancer. And of course, mammogram is one of the best ways to do that, to find the cancers early while they're small. And so super important to for women to continue to be able to screen and hopefully find those cancers early and save lives.
Could you talk me through a little bit of your advocacy journey from 2016 onwards? What were the sort of ups and downs and obstacles faced, and how does it feel now that you finally achieved the victory?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously when you start anything like this around health and you're wanting funding because effectively you're wanting a program or a drug or whatever it might be, and you're advocating for that. And so our journey started with basically understanding the data and understanding that we discovered through, I guess, our analysis that older women who continue with breast screening would have a 42% lower risk of dying from breast cancer. So really important for us to look at that older age group and try and expand the extra mammograms, free mammograms that those ladies could receive. So we got a 10,000 signature petition together back then. We went through Parliament, we went through the Select Committee, you know, we continued, nothing actually happened in terms of putting it into action. We then did another petition, we've done more Select Committees, and it's been on and on. And it's not that either governments have thought it was a bad idea. I think it's always about allocation of resource. But, I mean, I have to say we are very thankful that this government has listened and finally championed this change through the health system.
You talked about the data and the analysis. Do you have some numbers for us around the potential impact of this change, you know, even beyond just those who will now be able to access the screenings? What does it mean for their families? And
Yeah, that's a really good question, because our analysis tells us that we think we will save 20 lives every year just from this increase. Now, that might not sound like a big number, but as you've just noted, these women are grandmothers, they're mothers, they're aunts, they're sisters and wives and friends, and if you have a relation that's one of that 20, you're going to be very happy with the outcome from this. And so, you know, we think it's important we give women in their 70s a chance to detect breast cancer early and survive it.
Now, just to wrap up the questions on my end, there's still quite a few obstacles in our public health system for women. You know, the design of it is not necessarily adequate. Resourcing is sometimes lackluster. What do you think are the next steps here? What more needs to be done in the breast cancer field, but for women's health more broadly in Aotearoa?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big, huge question, isn't it? You know, basically for this particular initiative, we need to make sure that there is continued capacity in the system and that capacity continues to build so they can actually roll out this program, because obviously there's going to be increased demand and they need to make sure it's sufficiently resourced. And they have allocated funding to that in the 2024 budget. So we just need to keep abreast of that and making sure that all happens and rolls out. But, you know, for any women's health or the health system, I mean, there is a lot of process, but there's only limited funding. So it's all about, you know, understanding where, for our perspective, where in the system we can help. What can we do to partner to show them where, from an evidence base, where money is really going to make a difference? And, you know, we're lucky because we have the breast cancer register that of all the breast cancer patients in New Zealand that we've funded for years. So we have a lot of data that we can draw on to provide that evidence. And so that makes us really lucky because, you know, without evidence and data, it's very hard to get anything moving. So, you know, we know from that data, as an example, that your risk of breast cancer is actually higher at age 70 than it is at age 50. That all comes from our data. So it was easier for us to, you know, to advocate to say, well, stopping breast screening at 69 makes no sense because at the moment it's free from 45 to 50. So, of course, we need to go from 70 to 74. So, you know, just the system you know, there's a lot that can be done, but it's about, from a charity perspective, it's about really identifying those areas and providing that evidence and then advocating for your space.
Brilliant. And I'll just invite you, if there's any last things you want to say to our audience about this topic or your charity in general.
Well, I just want to say it's October, it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month, so make sure you're doing your checks. Honestly, finding a lump early is what saves your life, so please do your checks. If you're unsure about anything, see your GP, or you can ring our 0800 number, BC Nurse, and they'll be able to steer you in the right direction.
That was Justine Smythe, the chair of the Breast Cancer Foundation in New Zealand.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Earlier this month, the UN Subcommittee on the Prevention of Torture visited Aotearoa for the first time since 2013. The delegation made a range of unannounced visits to facilities such as prisons, police stations, and youth justice and protection residencies. The end-of-visit observations included a repeated emphasis on strengthening investment in and utility of our national preventative mechanism, the collective of Aotearoa's independent statutory organisations tasked with advancing the kaupapa to keep detained people safe. The subcommittee's final report will be delivered to Aotearoa's government, which is then up to the government discretion whether the document is made public. I spoke to Meg Duron, CEO of Te Kahui Tika Tangata, the Human Rights Commission, the coordinating body of the National Preventative Mechanism, about the subcommittee's statements. Kia ora, Meg. What is the HRC's coordinating role in the National Prevention Mechanism?
Kia ora, Jasmine. So Te Kahui Tika Tangata, the New Zealand Human Rights Commission, we are one of five organisations that make up the National Preventive Mechanism. Our role as the coordinating member is to ensure that there is good, clear representation to international bodies, including bodies like the Subcommittee on the Prevention of Torture. Our role is to bring the other four organisations together for regular hui or meetings in terms of our work. We make coordinated submissions, sometimes to domestic legislation and sometimes to international treaty bodies. And we also ensure that there is coordinated advocacy, press releases and annual reports on all of our work. So it's quite a substantial piece of mahi alongside all of the amazing work that the other four organisations do with us.
And how is progress in the mahi monitored and self-regulated outside of the UN subcommittee reporting and visits? I know you mentioned you release your own reports and you gather for hui. What does that look like? Could you paint me more of a picture?
Yeah, so we're part of obviously a bigger system, right? So under the optional protocol, which is designed to try and prevent torture occurring in countries, and it comes from the Convention Against Torture, which is a UN convention that our government has signed up to, we are part of the mechanism that supports our government to ensure they're designing a system that has the prevention of torture in mind. So it's not so much about investigating individual cases, but it's about ensuring that the conditions exist in the country for people who are held in detention to not be subject to cruel or inhuman or degrading treatment. So part of our work, although we do get to engage with the international bodies, you have to remember that the subcommittee last came in 2013, so it's been a really long time since they've actually been in Aotearoa, New Zealand. So in between times, we work closely with detaining agencies, so we ensure that they have the recommendations directly from the National Preventive Mechanism, so they know what concerns we might be seeing in places of detention. We also, as I mentioned, publish an annual report which details the findings in the different areas that our agencies look into. We also ensure that we have thematic reports or work. So for instance, we've had concerns around the continued use of seclusion and restraint practices in our criminal justice facilities. And so over a period of time from 2017 to 2021, we did a couple of focused reports on this issue with an international expert called Dr. Sharon Shalev. So there's lots of different ways that we're able to ensure that this area is, I guess, a focus for the state. So we use all of the tools at our disposal, including advocacy, public reporting, media comment, and obviously regular meetings with those concerned.
And the subcommittee made an observation upon their recent visit that it is unjust that time served on remand by children and young people does not count towards their sentence currently in Aotearoa, and that they advocate for that change, as I'm sure that the NPM is working towards as well. Do you have any more details on the advocacy for this facet in particular?
Yeah, so overall, the NPM is concerned about the increasing use of remand across all of our detention facilities. But with the youth jurisdiction, mokopuna can serve longer on remand than the longest sentence that's actually available in the youth court, and that time on remand isn't counted towards their sentence. So this is something that Mana Mokopuna and the Children's Commissioner, Dr. Claire Ahmed, has been raising for a long time now. And certainly there is sustained advocacy from the Children's Commission around this point. It's also something that we as the National Preventive Mechanism did draw to the attention of the SPT in terms of our concerns. So we were relieved to see that they have acknowledged that's an area that the government needs to urgently look at. And from our perspective, it's one of a number of issues for young people that we're aware of.
And what avenues exist for incarcerated peoples to speak upon their experiences for that messaging to reach you and then reach further to government and to the subcommittee?
Yeah, so just for your listeners, obviously people who are incarcerated in prison are some of the people that are covered under the National Preventive Mechanism. But the National Preventive Mechanism and OPCAT more broadly covers a large range of places where people are deprived of their liberty. So that can include mental health facilities, aged care facilities and so on. But for people that are incarcerated in prison, there's a number of avenues in which they can speak up or raise concerns. And that's both obviously once they're outside of prison or if they are still in facilities. So there are internal complaints mechanisms that are in prisons, and we always encourage people to use those and to continue to use them to ensure that they're documenting concerns they have. There's the Office of the Inspectorate, which prisoners can make complaints to, the Office of the Ombudsman. They can complain to the Human Rights Commission, and that tends to be the second or third largest group that comes to us through our complaints mechanism. There's also the Health and Disability Rights Commissioner and the Privacy Commissioner. But there's also lots of other advocacy organisations that work in this space and do amazing mahi, including the Howard League, People Against Prisons, or PAPA, Amnesty International, Just Speak. So there's a range of different avenues for people who have concerns to speak up, and as the National Preventive Mechanism, we work as closely as we can with civil society as well, including, where possible, ensuring that the voices of people with lived experience are heard. So, for instance, we did a range of speaking slots on women's experience in prison and those profiled people who had lived experience in that space. So there's lots of different ways that people who have been incarcerated or who are incarcerated can speak up, but we're obviously aware it is much, much harder, and there are many barriers to people who are in prison to do so. So we need to be mindful of that as well.
The non-government sector is doing an incredible breadth of mahi in this space, as you spoke to. What role does the public sector versus the private sector have in answering to the wider interests of this kaupapa?
Yeah, so in terms of the public sector, so we as the New Zealand Human Rights Commission, we're what's called an independent Crown entity. So we are independent of the state, but we're obviously still part of the state, as is the National Preventative Mechanism. As you've acknowledged, there's a whole range of wonderful NGOs and not-for-profits that work in this space. But there's also the really interesting component that we have, that there are private sector organisations that have obligations in this space. And that comes about because under our system, I guess, you've got aged care facilities that are run by private providers, and you do occasionally have private companies that are involved in criminal justice as well. So they have the obligation to follow the law, but the primary obligation to keep people free from torture still sits with the state, even if there is a private provider. But those private providers have to open themselves up to visits from the MPM. They have to open themselves up to visits from the Subcommittee on the Prevention of Torture, and they obviously have to have systems in place to ensure that there's appropriate reporting and keeping people safe as well as their dignity intact when they are deprived of their liberty.
The UN Subcommittee recommendations was to put more of a focus on the mahi of your collective and for the government to focus on more investment in this area long term. What do you think the path is to securing that longer term approach to that support of the National Preventative Mechanism?
We obviously welcomed this recommendation from the Subcommittee or this initial finding from the Subcommittee, bearing in mind that the formal recommendation haven't been provided to the government yet. This is actually something that was recommended back in the 2013 visit as well in terms of adequate funding. And I think what can be tricky when you implement complex systems like this is that sometimes they get set up with the best of intentions, but as time goes on, there can become a bit of complacency, I guess, in terms of funding of those systems. So when there are public sector cuts, those can impact on mechanisms like this that we sometimes take for granted. So the New Zealand Human Rights Commission, for instance, was subject to a 10% budget cut in the previous budget round and had a previous reduction in funding in the years prior to that. So I think that was part of what the subcommittee was picking up on, and those budget cuts have impacted a couple of the other agencies that do this work as well. So it is tricky to try and do what is an increasing mandate, increasing prison population, increasing areas of deprivation of liberty that come under the mandate, but actually to cover them with sometimes less pūtea, less money. I guess what is really important is ensuring that these organisations have independence from the government but appropriate government funding to carry out that mahi, and that needs to be long-term and enduring rather than something that can be taken away when priorities change, because obviously the government's obligation and commitment to prevent torture is not a commitment that they can shift away from or ignore. So, yeah, our recommendation is obviously that it is funded appropriately across the organisations, including the coordinating role, which is a really important role. Partly why it's so important is to make sure that the recommendations that we provide are actually implemented. And that was another point noted by the subcommittee, is their concern that even though it's been 12 years since they were last here, there are still a large number of recommendations that haven't been implemented and ones that the NPM have made that haven't been implemented. So appropriate funding would enable us to ensure that happens.
That was Meg Durand, CEO of Te Kahui Tika Tangata, the Human Rights Commission, on the mahi of the National Preventative Mechanism in light of the recent visit of the UN Subcommittee on the Prevention of Torture to Aotearoa.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. This is The Sofa from Wolf Alice.
Hope I can accept the wild thing in me. Hope nobody comes to tame her. She can be free. Sick of second guessing my behavior and what I want to be. Just let me lie. California, where I thought I might clean the slate.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
The Science System Advisory Group, headed by Sir Peter Gluckman, released its second report yesterday detailing new proposals for New Zealand's science and innovation ecosystem. As a part of this report and the government's response, a massive shakeup of the funding regime has been announced, with the establishment of, quote, Research Funding New Zealand, a new independent board that will replace most existing decision makers across science. At the same time, this report outlines a clear lack of investment funding and strategic leadership in terms of how New Zealand's science ecosystem can solve problems that benefit all New Zealanders beyond short-term economic growth. Te Punaha Matatini is a research institute trying to solve the complex and wicked problems of the 21st century in Aotearoa. I spoke with their co-director, Marcus Lucas Roche, about these announcements and what the future of New Zealand's science ecosystem needs to look like. So what are the changes being made to the science funding system as outlined in the SSAG report, and has the government responded to these recommendations yet?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I'd like to start answering it this way. To understand the changes being made to the science funding system as outlined in the SSAG report, I think it's important to start from what are they actually changing from? For many people, that's not always clear. It comes as there's changes to something. So I think it's important to understand that there is a science and research system in New Zealand, and it is known to be underfunded in international comparison. So New Zealand investment in science and research doesn't hold up. There are very diverse institutional structures. So in the past, we had Crown Research Institutes, for example, to deliver applied research in the interest of the New Zealand public. We have universities, of course. We have centers of research excellence are part of a research system. The main point is there's people working in the research system. We also have researchers at local government level working in the research system, actually, right? So it's actually a diverse system of people doing research and science to address challenges, to discover new things, which then might lead to products. And there was always an identified lack of transfer from more fundamental discoveries or work on research questions to entrepreneurship. But what's actually true for New Zealand system is that researchers are punching above their weight in terms of the scale of this country, the quality and the quantity of the research output, if you look at all the reports, is actually very, very respectable. Given that, there is a historic underfunding. So that's, I think, important to understand. And I think to anyone who listens to this, is also important that researchers and scientists are members of this society. So these are people who are going to work. They chose the science career to work in that profession because they have this sort of very detailed expertise over a long time of dealing with specific questions. So that's, I think, the starting point, what we're changing from. So we're changing the system for these people working in it. And so what the government is changing in response to the SSAG report, the SSAG report says we should solve the underfunding issue. Yeah, we should fund this more robustly because the system is very fragile. Because those people working in it are people. So they go to work, they have stress through workload, they have families that they're spending time with, but underfunding a system, we put strain on the system because we may distribute the weight on fewer people's shoulders, and we might also not always see what these people actually do while they're doing their work, because they have to disseminate their research and so on and so forth. And by underfunding them, we cut them off, for example, from international collaboration. And so solve the underfunding issue is one big thing that the SSAG report outlines to change, with recommendations that are in the detail. And the second part is that it recommends to change the institutional layout, how this funding is given into the system and provided to the different people and entities that undertake research, which in the past was quite diverse. So different institutions were the places where you could ask for research funding, where you would deliver your proposals to, and they are recommending to change that. Now, the government has taken up quite a few of those, recommendation, so to change the institutional makeup of how funding is disseminated, and also how decisions about funding are made, which means there will be an individual institution to administer the funding, which is one body that researchers will go to ask for a lot of the different research programs, and there will be another new entity as well that sets the strategic priorities, what funding should go to. So I think that's probably the best way to explain to people what is going on here, because there's, if you read the reports, a long list of very detailed changes that have all very, very different, sometimes very local implications, sometimes more systemic one. But I think from a high level, the important bit is the government picks up structural changes, and they will have implications, and some of them will be useful for researchers because it takes away confusion of where to ask and the timelines and the alignment of funding. But it might also centralize the decision-making about research strategy, so what we find important to support, in a single entity that now carries a lot of responsibility of getting the answer to that right in the interest of New Zealand's public.
That's a good segue into the second question. The government over the last, over this term has talked about science research in terms of delivering economic benefit and growth for New Zealanders. How do you feel about this strategic insistence on growth and economic return in science? And do you think that these reforms that the government's choosing to pick up, these structural changes, are set to achieve this? Or are we still lacking something, lacking a final kicker or a silver bullet in this ecosystem?
Maybe I say two things about that one. So first is what will or might deliver economic benefit now may actually not do so in the future. So there is a concern around this sort of all eggs in one basket danger, which means when you prioritize very strictly with, as we just heard, a limited amount of research funding, and actually not an increasing, not even with inflation, so in net terms, decreasing amount of research funding, and then concentrating that actually means the winners get picked, but they might not be the winners in 100 years' time. So there's this sort of long-term forward-thinking risk that might miss economic potentials that we can't even foresee just yet. And the second thing to say is that there is research with immediate economic benefit that has a shorter pathway to commercialization. But that sometimes only appears so. It appears very short and very fast once something gets patented, for example, and commercialized. But usually there is 10, 20 years of research happening before that. So the time to scientific impact in commercialization for a lot of things that are quite transformative and disruptive to how we do things or what we do can take a long time. So there's a sort of timescale issue with economic benefit that kind of expects something to happen that isn't necessarily so by the nature of the amount of thinking and work it takes to discover a potential area of progress. And so there is a huge risk in that currently there is a very, very short-term expectation that in lots of areas can't even be necessarily fulfilled.
I suppose the question then to ask is, as given your field and given your expertise, ideally, a science ecosystem for funding and research pipelines is able to enable New Zealand scientists to not only deliver economic benefit, but to solve complex systems levels problems. In your view, what do you think needs to happen for our science system from the bottom up, right? Speaking from schools and communities all the way up to cutting edge research at our universities, what do you think needs to happen? What do you think needs to change in order to actually enable that sort of complex system level problem solving and that economic benefit that doesn't premeditate winners, but shapes markets and growth?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. It kind of ties a little bit, as you said, to that economic growth question as well, because one thing that you need for economic growth or for being an entrepreneurial nation is actually being an entrepreneurial nation, right? And that means that spirit has to be in the culture. It has to be a desirable career pathway. So you don't just say, oh, the university is now commercialized and then all this entrepreneurial activity is going to happen. But New Zealanders have to think that that is what they want to do. And if you want to think that all the way through from the bottom up, what you want to do is you want to inspire kids. And I think you don't want to inspire them just for science or just for STEM. You want to inspire them to think about like really long-term futures. You want to think people to think about, how will we build houses? How will we access food? How will we connect to each other using technology? Yeah, so that instead of saying, oh, we want to invest in advanced technology, it's actually the question of how we eat, what we eat, how we access health services. It's those bigger challenges that come with a vast complexity, and the answer to any of those is not just an advanced technology answer, but it's actually the coordination of thought around how do we go about this with solutions, but also what does that do, for example, to human behavior and our communities, and is that actually going to improve outcomes? And that includes that the people are part of that intellectual endeavor across a range of jobs and activities, and it's not just an isolated concern for scientists to think about something and then we magically transform. It's actually an imagination of what New Zealand of the future looks like, and that's where you want children at all levels of school, you want them to be part of that conversation. And that will lead for people to actually envision careers in science, envision careers in technology, because they know why they're doing it, what they're doing it for. So I think that's the critical piece to turn generations into potential scientists is by giving them that sort of bigger purpose of why we're doing it for each other, because it's about having a vision of the place and finding where people can be part of creating it.
That was Marcus Lucas Roche on the recent changes to New Zealand science funding and research regime.
That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nā te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kororo mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Dā Pare Thursday. Nei rā, hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour's Shannon Halbert, Auckland Council's Shane Henderson, Breast Cancer Foundation Chair Justine Smythe, Tupunaha Matatini Co-Director Marcus Luxak Roche, Te Kahui Tika Tangata Human Rights Commission's Meg D. Ronde, and you're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Sophia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.